Harmon Dale, he understands it. He understands a lot about the Vancouver Canucks, which is why we bring him on. He's from The Athletic, and he joins us now. Harmon, how are you today? There he is. I know you're on the line. We didn't hear your answer. Are you doing well, Harmon? Are you safe and healthy?
Oh, yes, I am. Sorry, I didn't hear you guys. When I got put on, I just heard blank. I'm doing well. What was the question, guys?
Oh, we're just asking how you were doing. We understand there's technological challenges right now. You're working from home like everybody else right now. Obviously, it's impacted your day today as you go about your job trying to write for The Athletic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, and I imagine you guys can attest to this best, trying to do sports radio with no sports going on. It's definitely a challenge, and from my perspective, just trying to do my best to get in touch with people over the phone, and try and find unique angles and continue covering hockey the best way we can.
I'm not sure if that challenge is greater than what Nolan Baumgartner and Travis Green had with their defensive core the first 2 years, but I digress. To you, Harmon, what is the biggest indicator of improvement in this group overall from last season to this season?
Well, I think it starts, number one, with the addition of Quinn Hughes, obviously, and it's pretty crazy to think about where he's at now and where the expectations were going into the season. I mean, to have a 20-year-old rookie defenseman step into the league right away and make his mark and establish himself as a bona fide number one defenseman. You're seeing sort of the same thing in Colorado with Cale Makar, and you take it for granted, but this is virtually unprecedented. It's very rare to see a young defenseman be able to make that type of impact right away. And it's not only the type of offensive difference Hughes is making as one of the NHL's top offensive blue liners, but just his two-way impact as well. And that's what has really allowed Travis Green the trust to play him in matchup minutes, is the maturity of his two-way game. And just having someone who can play those big minutes, that has a trickle-down effect and helps out someone like Alex Edler, who over time, he of course, has been slowing down a little, and for him to take a little bit less of a workload, that helps his game out. And so he's a game changer, and that really gives you 20-25 minutes a night where you're able to control the flow of play and transition the puck up the ice well. So I think he makes the biggest difference. And then, of course, to have someone like Tyler Myers added to the top four as well, that's a huge help. So between those two guys, you can just see the ability of this team to transition the puck up the ice has improved so much, especially when you consider who was subtracted in the likes of Eric Goodbranson and Derek Pouliot.
When it comes to Quinn Hughes, like, I think we thought there would be some points there. Are you surprised that it's been this level, right? While we highlight the two-way play and he's been far better defensively than I think we ever anticipated, like the astonishing numbers that he's putting up is blowing away even our expectations.
Absolutely. We figured that he would be able to quarterback the top power play unit and rack up some points, but it's kind of similar to Elias Pettersson last year, where you wouldn't have expected him to rack up these numbers. I mean, he had a legitimate shot here to, and it would have been an outside chance, but to beat Pettersson's rookie point record. I mean, he's top five among NHL defensemen in points already. These are the type of numbers I expected. I mean, you talk about 53 points in 68 games. That's what I imagined, I think, peak Quinn Hughes might have been when the Canucks originally drafted him, and that would have been sort of a best-case scenario. So he's blown all expectations out of the water. And, I mean, I keep making the comparison between him and Pettersson, but it's just so apt. I mean, we knew these guys had the potential to be superstars in the league, but we didn't know that it would happen right away. Like, when it came to Pettersson last year, we were saying maybe he can be a 40-point guy, a 40-50-point player. With Quinn Hughes, I was thinking maybe he can finish the season with 40 points, and that would be like an A-plus type season, and he had a shot to hit 60-plus here. So, I mean, he's exceeded even the most optimistic expectations.
You mentioned there Kyler Myers as well just a brief minute ago. Obviously, he was the big acquisition. And like I've come to use the term, he's the inkblot D-man, that if you're anti-Tyler Myers, you're going to see what you want to see. And if you're pro-Tyler Myers, you're going to see what you want to see. Just judging his season as a whole, have the Canucks gotten value just for 1 year out of that contract?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about value as far as a $6 million player, I think that would be hard to justify because that's top pairing value. But as far as whether he's been a positive contributor, absolutely. He's been a very solid number four quality defenseman to me. And he's shown the ability. I mean, first month of the season, he goes up and the Canucks had a very hot October that sort of set the tone for the season. And when he played alongside Alex Edler, he did so against the opposition's best players, and that pairing was an integral part of the team's early success. And as the season sort of went on, as you mentioned, he's a very divisive player in that, and I like to make the Jake Gardner comparison. You see what you want to see out of Myers because he does have these sort of loud mistakes, but at the same time, if you sort of take a step back and look at whether the pros outweigh the cons, the answer would be yes. He does a lot more good than he does bad. His two-way profile, the Canucks, when Myers steps on the ice, they're doing a much better job of controlling shots and scoring chances compared to when he's on the bench. And it reflects in the goal differentials as well. The Canucks aren't getting out, scored by significant margins when he's been deployed. And he has been put in a tough circumstance. Early in the season, he's playing top competition, and then, later in the season through the second half, he's put alongside Oscar Fantenberg, and you think that's a little bit more of a limited role. But if you take sort of a peek under the hood and look at Fantenberg's performance, he's been one of the NHL's worst defensemen at controlling play, and so Myers has had to navigate through that. And from my perspective, I think all things considered, the Canucks have gotten pretty good value in their first year with Tyler Myers, maybe not fully justifying that $6 million cap hit, but definitely he's exceeded my expectations in his first season wearing blue and green.
In conversation with The Athletic's Harmon Dahl today on Canucks Central and your home of Vancouver hockey, Sportsnet 650. Apply that same lens to Troy Stetcher. How do you evaluate his season?
Honestly, and for me to put the context and perspective out there, I've usually been a big proponent of Stetcher's game. I think he's shown in seasons past that maybe he started on a bottom pairing, but as injuries sort of went on and the Canucks had limited defensive depth, he would sort of creep up and solidify himself in the top four. So I really like his game, but this season, I think for most of the year, it's been a tough going, and I think he's underperformed my expectations, I'd say. And it's just sort of strange. I mean, I remember the first moment he was paired with Jordy Benn, I figured that would be an opportunity for the Canucks to sort of, I thought that was an above average third pair, and for whatever reason, it just didn't click. And when I looked at Stetcher's game, what looked different was he just seemed, I mean, a big strength of his game when he's on it is his ability to move the puck up the ice and lead possession breakouts. And that just wasn't there for most of this season. He seemed under duress a lot of the time. He seemed to have issues with puck retrievals and sort of making plays and sort of he seemed like he was a step behind. It always seemed that he had forechecking pressure on him, and so his transition game just in my opinion hasn't been up to par. And then he has had defensive mistakes here and there. That's another part of his game where I've always thought his own zone play has been relatively solid, and this season it just quite hasn't been there. So to my eyes, he's been more of a number 5-6 this season. I think he's nowhere near sort of the disappointment that I might have in someone like Jordy Benn, but I think he's been below par relative to sort of the higher standards that I evaluate him on.
Both he and Chris Tanev are free agents of varying manners this summer. The Canucks could move on from both. They could retain both. If you were in that GM's chair, what would you do?
Look, I think if you look at Vancouver's cap situation, they're right up against it. There's no secret, and especially with Jacob Markstrom and Tyler Toffoli, to me, those are two guys that are higher on the priority list than someone like Chris Tanev, and I say that for a variety of different reasons, but most importantly, I mean, just look at the contract someone like Anton Stralman got in free agency last year. And Stralman was a 33-year-old. He had a worse season than Tanev. He played in less games, put up less points, and he got 5.5 per year times 3 years to the Florida Panthers. And so now you look at Chris Tanev. I'm worried about what any type of contract he signs looks like, because you look at him now. He's 30 years old. He's got a lot of miles on his body, an extensive injury list, and look, I mean, that's a symptom of the fact that he's been a warrior for this team for so many years and put his body and sacrificed his health for the organization. But it's scary to think about what age-related decline and how that might combine with the injuries that he's already sustained throughout his career. I'm wary of a long-term extension that might be in the $5, maybe even $6 million territory. So to me, I look at Tanev, I just don't think you can justify it on a long-term basis. And if that's the case, I mean, Troy Stetcher would come in a lot cheaper. And to me, if you can, especially being a local hometown kid, it wouldn't surprise me if he actually signed something pretty close to his qualifying offer, which I believe is 2 and change. So if you could lock him up for, say, $2.5 million, I think the way you have to kind of look at it is this. With Vancouver's salary cap situation, they're going to need to find efficiency somewhere. If Troy Stetcher is a player who can, let's say, give you 75% of what Chris Tanev brings to the table, but he's doing so for 40 or 50% of the cost, then that's something that the Canucks might have to consider if it allows them to re-up someone like Tyler Toffoli.
The other thing I look at too, Harmon, when it comes to that contract for Chris Tanev, and he's going to get a raise from what he's making right now, 4.45. And you can't be paying $5+ million for non-power play players, no matter how good they are defensively. And, you know, he brings defensive value, but he's not like elite as far as shutting guys down. He's very strong, but he's paid the right price. And you look at contracts that have been handed out both on left-hand and right-side D-mans for expensive penalty killers. They don't exactly live up to that contract. And if you're going to hand out money, that's why the Tyler Myers one I look at, it's okay, $6 million. And yes, he's going to have defensive issues, but you're going to get goals out of him. You should get a lot more points than he's been given because of the power play deployment. But you start trending in a way that you're overvaluing your penalty kill. Well, that's how teams get caught into contract problems.
Yeah, and I think what you're seeing is the trajectory of Tanev's two-way play has slowly been deteriorating, and it began last season where you looked at a lot of the underlying data. And to provide context, throughout the prime of his career, Tanev was one of those players sort of in the Nicklas Hjalmarsson territory as far as his defensive prowess and being one of the NHL's elite defensive defensemen. He was right up there, but he's not at that same level. He's had sort of a slow decline that accelerated last year, and you notice it when you watch him skate with his ability to sort of, again, I keep talking about moving the puck up the ice. It's so important in the modern game, and his feet sort of seem to start to slow down last season, and his ability to escape pressure in his own zone just wasn't quite the same as it was last year. Now, playing with Quinn Hughes this year, I think that's been a best-case scenario for him because he's got someone in Hughes who can sort of take control of the puck and sort of be a one-man breakout machine. But I think if anything, that's maybe masked some of the sort of, I wouldn't call them deficiencies in his game, but something that's maybe a growing weakness that might be a concern in the long run. And so with Tanev, it's one of those things where I think at this stage of his career, he's already a number four defenseman, and he could quite quickly become worse than that, as we mentioned, with the injuries and the age-related decline that players see through their 30s. So I think we're on the same page here. A contract for Tanev that would stretch long-term would be quite the risk for the Canucks.
We're talking tan, man. Not sure it's sunny enough outside for you to get a tan, man, but we will leave you on that. Harmon, a bad pun gets you out. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Mike.